what can be accomplished in this Republican House?
Well, I think it's really interesting that when we talked about reducing taxes for working class families, not a Republican applauds. When you talk about taxing or a fair share tax for corporations and billionaires, not a Republican applauds. But when you talk about oil and gas, a lot of their corporate donors, they all clap. I really hope that the American people see the hypocrisy that I saw in that chamber last night. I applaud the president for what he said. I thought he sounded incredibly progressive when he said that. And it's something that a number of us have been saying for a very, very long time. The idea that you make $80,000 a year and you are being taxed more than a billionaire is unacceptable. It's enraging. That's what I hear at the doors. I hear about property tax and income tax. If I make a little more, I'm actually making less because of how much I'm paying in taxes. That's unacceptable. If you make $6 billion a year and you pay your fair share at 20%, here's the thing. You're still a billionaire with $4 billion. I applaud him. And I think there's a number of things we could be doing through executive action. And that's what I was talking about last night. Look, I don't pretend to assume or believe that somehow we're going to have a miracle and a number, maybe 6 or 7 Republicans are going to come our way. Because I hear them talking behind the chamber. But you know, you're right. It's actually a really good piece of legislation. You're right. We shouldn't be voting for that. But when they get into that chamber, they vote that party line, even if they don't agree with it. So I know that we won't have the legislative action that we need in this Congress, but we have to do everything in our power through executive action to ensure that we provide the protections, that we provide the resources, that we build the economy with working families at the center of it. And when we do that, when we show people that we find creative ways to protect and support, then the American people will go to the ballot box and remember that in 2024 so we can get the majority we need and no excuses and pass the legislation we should on climate, on immigration, on housing, on economy, raising the minimum wage, getting to a living wage. And let's show what we can do now.
And economist Dean Baker, what you feel can be accomplished in this Republican House? And an incredibly important point that Congressmember Ramirez raised is the pressure that's been brought on Biden. This is not the Biden you have followed for decades, Dean.
Yeah, he's clearly moved to the left, which, again, obviously that responds to pressure. I mean, the progressive segments of the Democratic Party are far more important today than they were 30 years ago. So that's clearly behind his movement. But it's a great thing to see. I mean, again, I don't know how much he'll be able to accomplish in this Congress. But I'll just point out, you're referring, well, we had the section on his speech about climate change. We've turned the dial on that. I don't mean to say, you know, obviously climate change is going to continue to be an enormous problem. We're going to suffer enormous hardships here and elsewhere in the world, of course. But we've so much changed the picture with his infrastructure bill and particularly the Inflation Reduction Act. You now have companies that are all in on electric cars, massive industries in terms of solar and wind. That can't be turned back. So that is really, really huge. Now, obviously, we're going to have to do a lot more. We have to keep the pressure up, but we have to recognize what's been done. We are moving forward with a clean energy transition. That's not stoppable.
Well, Dean Baker, we want to thank you so much for being with us from Astoria, Oregon, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Congressmember Delia Ramirez, Democrat of Illinois, speaking to us from the Capitol. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Schaaf, Maria Teresaina, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. We're still hearing responses to the jogger who was on our show who wanted a word to say when he's coming up behind somebody so that he doesn't startle them. And I think the most popular suggestion turned out to be just to say, on your left or on your right. But we also heard from Victoria Wolf in Sacramento, California, who said that conversation brought up another question that's been bugging her. Say you're driving a car and you make a mistake, and you know it's your mistake. You pulled out in front of somebody when you shouldn't have. How do you signal to them, oops, my bad?
Oh, I know what I do. I mouth the word sorry in exaggerated facial expressions. I get as close to the windshield as I can so they can really see my face. And I don't know if it works, but it makes me feel better.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I struggled with this myself because I feel like if I stuck my face close to the window and said, sorry, you know, they might think I'm saying something nasty to them. And, you know, I mean, I know that I've done these things where I've been waving my arms like, oops, oops, you know, it's my bad. I know, you know, I'm pointing to myself, but I'm sure it just looks like somebody who's furious. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, how do we say, oops, my mistake? And all I could think of, Grant, was that I looked up the sign in American Sign Language for sorry, the word sorry, and you form a fist in your hand and you rotate it on your chest using a couple of clockwise motions. I don't know that that would work. I don't know that the people are going to see that, but I hope that somebody has a good idea for us because I think this would be one small step for civility in our culture.
Yeah, because we have some of these other hand signals that are clear, like the little how you doing hand flap, whether your hand's on the steering wheel where you only lift up the fingers.
The hand flap.
And we've got the little you go ahead hand motion, you know, and it's not clear whose turn it is or there's a pedestrian waiting to cross. So some of this stuff is very clear, but you're right. This is a gap. This is not a lexical gap. This is a gesture gap.
I would love to know what people suggest for us.
Well, the toll-free line is open in Canada and the United States, 877-929-9600. 673, answer this question if you would, or tell us your language thoughts, stories, and ideas. You can also tell us an email, words@waywardradio.org, or let's have a fun chat on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, my name is Heidi. I live in Vermont. And the question I have is regarding the term call out that sounds very strange to me because I would use the term call in. I would say I'm going to call in sick. My daughters, who are in their 20s and they work at a cafe, I would overhear them talking and they'd say, oh, so-and-so called out today. And that means that the person was sick and they called in to work to say that they were sick and weren't able to come in. But they say called out and everybody knows it means that you're sick and not coming to work. And that just sounds very foreign to me because you're calling into work.
Right.
So I'm wondering whether that's a generational thing or if it's a regional thing. I grew up in the Midwest, although when I was in the workforce, I'm self-employed now, so I never get to call in sick. But when I was in the workforce, I worked in Michigan and I also worked in Massachusetts, and I have never heard the term call out used until just in the past few years, hearing it from my daughters.
Okay.
So wonderful to get the field report.
Yes.
And you've laid it out so nicely for us with all the details and the descriptions and everything. We have talked about this before, and I bring that up just to say that lots of people called us and wrote us when we talked about this before with their information and their detail about where they were and how old they are. And so we know a little bit based on our callers. And it turns out that calling out sick is based in the New York City metropolitan region. It's not only there, but it's mostly there. And so it doesn't seem to be about an age difference, really. It's just about geography at this point. And most of the country, by far and away, a ratio of something like 5 to 1, is likely to say, call in. They'll call in sick. And really, some of it is about perspective. So are you calling into the office, or are you calling that you're going to be out? So that's kind of what's happening here. So does the out describe you, or does the in describe what you're doing with the call? See what's happening.
Yes, I would
there?
Agree with the latter there.
Some people are thinking about themselves being out, and so that's what they're calling about. They're calling about their being out.
Yeah, I'm thinking when I used to work in offices, I would definitely call in sick. But I guess now that I work at home, it's sort of like, do I call over sick? I call down the hall sick. I call down sick, you know, down to the hall.
Barbara from Maine tells us that nurses and paramedics and firefighters that she knows all say call off sick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But that's even rarer than call out sick.
Yeah. Is that regional too, or that's by vocation?
We don't have enough information. It's so rare that we just simply can't put a tag on that. More information needed. You know, always delighted to get more field reports on call off sick. And there's another interesting thing here. So in organized labor, there's a kind of strike where workers use their sick time all on the same days to force an issue with their employers. And it's called either a sick out or a sick in. So even in a strike like that, there's like some confusion about in and out. It's both a sick out and a sick in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to know what the grammatically correct thing is so that I can
both
win the argument with my daughters.
Both.
Oh.
The problem here is that you've got two different phrasal verbs, call in and call out. And so you don't break them up. So call out behaves as a unit and call in behaves as a unit. And so they're both grammatically correct, and they're both culturally correct and sociologically correct. They're correct in every aspect. It's simply a matter of preference. And so you can force your use on them by fiat, but perhaps you should marvel at the difference instead and start to take a note of what other people say and see if you can figure out more about it. Like if you discover that there are people around you who do say call off sick, and oh, wait, are they all firefighters, or do they work in a field related to medicine? You know, something like that.
Yeah.
So just put that disagreement and just marvel at the novelty that your children are different than you. They're not a part of you, although they feel like it, right?
They are. Yeah. And that's a great perspective to enjoy, that we can both be right, even though we're using a different phrase.
Right. Here's hoping you all stay healthy anyway and don't have to do
that.
That's right. We don't have to call in or call out. That's the best plan.
Thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Be well.
Yep. Thanks. Bye.
877-929-9673 or email us words@waywardradio.org. Welcome to Away with Words.
Hello, Grant. It's David Lamott calling from Black Mountain, North Carolina.
What's on your mind?
So I was listening to an episode that y'all did recently where you encountered a Spanish phrase that translates into English as a crocodile in your pocket to describe somebody who's stingy because their wallet's in there with the crocodile.
Right.
And I was really wonderfully amused by that, and it got me to thinking about my favorite word in Spanish, which is tocayo, T-O-C-A-Y-O. Tocayo means one who shares my name. So anybody who has the same first name as you is your tocayo or tocaya in the feminine form. And I got to thinking about the fact that that doesn't translate into English. It's such a charming word. It's like you use it kind of like you'd use homeboy. Like even if you met somebody for the first time, if you're from the same town, then you have this little thing in common. And so it's just a little celebration of that. It's a expression of soft kinship. And I kind of love the word, but it doesn't exist in English. And I got to thinking about words that don't translate. And that just got me fascinated. I wondered if y'all had any other thoughts on Tokayo or on words that don't translate.
I do love the word Tokayo, and I learned it from a Spanish speaker whose name is, guess what, Marta.
Oh, Marta, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I agree with you. There is something really lovely about that connection, and we always, whenever we see each other, you know, we say, hey, Tokaya. And I don't know, it sort of separates you out from everybody else and connects you to that one person. I really enjoy that term.
It reminds me of another Spanish word. Like tocayo has gone beyond the literal meaning of to a figurative meaning. So tocayo could be used for somebody who doesn't share your name, but they share your spirit or your outlook on life, or you kind of have an emotional kinship with them. And the Spanish word cuate, C-U-A-T-E, and it's used originally for a non-identical twin, a fraternal twin. In places like Mexico, Guatemala, and Venezuela, or you might call somebody a cuatito or cuatita. That's the more familiar form. But it's also used, again, for somebody like tocayo or tocaya, somebody who is your twin in spirit, your twin in outlook on life, your twin in interests, or your twin in your goals or your perspective, that sort of thing. And I think that's... For me, cuate and tocayo, that's what they're doing that makes them so compelling as words. It's not just that they're literal uses, it's their figurative uses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm trying to think of an English equivalent, and I can't really.
No, it takes several words to explain it. We have a lot of listeners around the world who speak a huge number of languages, and people who are very creative at coming up with their own words or their own expressions. So we'd love to hear from everyone. What's a word that you already know or an expression you already know that brings across the idea of tocayo, someone who not just shares your name, but shares your spirit in kinship. They're like you in outlook, identity, and feeling. We'd love to hear it. Let us know, 877-929-9673, or tell us on Twitter at WAYWORD. David, we'll see what we get.
All right. I appreciate your hospitality. Nice to talk with you all, mis cuates.
Mis cuates.
All right. Adios.
Ciao.
Adios.
That number again is 877-929-9673. Here's one of my favorite words from Old English, fneozung.
Bless you.
Well, exactly, that's what it means. It means sneeze in Old English.
No. I had no idea. How do you spell that? And why don't we use it anymore?
F-N-E-O-Z-U-N-G, fneozung.
Fneozung, wow.
Sneeze. Why sneeze. Don't we say that anymore?
Oh, well.
877-929-9673.
For all of our past episodes and show notes, go to waywardradio.org.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. And, well, I guess he's been rescuing cats from trees. He's certainly tall enough. It's our quiz guy, John Chinesky. Hi, John.
Hi, Grant. Hi, Martha. I'm always happy to help getting a cat out of a tree, so please give me a call. Now, this week, the quiz is one of our staples, the takeoff. It's a variation on a National Puzzlers League puzzle type, but it's very simple. You take a word, you take its first letter off, and a new word is left behind. I'll read a sentence that contains clues to both the original word and the resultant word. You tell me both of them. And this week, we're taking off the letter I from the beginning of the word, or the letter J from the beginning of all these words, because there's just about enough I's and J words to make up a quiz. Okay?
Okay.
Plus, I and J, they're very similar. Here's the example. If I say, My factory makes statues of the saints, and we employ men only recently out of prison. The two words that are clued are?
Icon and con.
Right, icons okay. and cons, right, or icon, right. Okay, here's the others. The catcher avoided the sliding runner with a nimble leap, but he landed on the official anyway.
The catcher avoided the runner with a sliding leap, but
with a nimble leap, but he landed on the official anyway.
As opposed to a jump.
Yeah.
Landing on the ump.
Exactly, jump and ump. Taking off the J from jump, you get ump. When the judge announced the winner of the tilt, the guards took it as a sign to topple the king.
Joust and oust.
Mm-hmm. Yes, joust. To tilt on horses is a joust, and toppling the king is to oust them. It would be absolutely perfect if you could get me a really good rate on that rental car.
Oh, ideal and deal.
Yes, very nice.
Good work.
Well done. My mother suddenly packed us into the car for a quick trip to visit her sister.
Ah, her sister. So it's your aunt, and it's a jaunt.
Yes, a jaunt to visit our aunt or aunt. Yeah.
A jaunt.
Here's the last one. I took a tour of the detention center, and now I don't feel so good.
Jail and ale.
Mm-hmm. Jail and ale, yes. Very good.
Oh, thank you so much, John.
Appreciate it. Talk to you later, dude.
Talk to you next week.
Bye.
So if you want to talk to us, all you have to do is give us a call, 877-929-9673, or send your thoughts about language to words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Connie Charles. I'm from Santee, California.
Ah, just outside San Diego. Well, great. What's on your mind today, Connie?
Well, I was curious about a word that I have seen used more than once recently, because I've been reading about the South, and I have been reading Isabel Wilkerson's books, Cast and The Warmth of Other Suns. But she talks about shotgun houses as if it needs to be stated. In other words, this is something typical, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you take that to mean when she talks about a shotgun house?
Well, when you think about a shotgun, you think about the shot spraying out in many directions. But then I looked it up in the dictionary, and I saw that it had to do with houses that had one room going, I guess, with a doorway into another. In other words, without a hallway that rooms would go off of. So that was what I'm picturing.
Yeah, that's right. The house is basically one room wide, and usually built perpendicular to the street. And there are two or more rooms all in a row, no hallway, each room leading into the next. It's usually one story tall and maybe has a gable or a porch in the front. Yeah, and that's a shotgun house.
But why shotgun?
One theory that I saw in a newspaper article published, a long time ago, 1908, was that these were houses that people with not a lot of money lived in. They were housing for the poor, people who worked in the fields, or people who had a hard time making rent. And so the landlord would come around with a shotgun to collect the rent. And there's one story in the Charlotte Observer from 1908 where he says one landlord frankly said that it is his custom to use a shotgun in the collection of rents, and that he admits that he expects to kill some of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's one theory. Another theory that was come up with by John Vlach, V-L-A-C-H, and he did some great work to connect the shotgun house to Haitian and the West African traditions. He suggests it might be a form of a word from a language family from West Africa, particularly the Dogon, D-O-G-O-N, of Mali. where a word that kind of sounds like it means a large shelter or the house of talk, usually reserved for men to go to discuss life, business, or to take a nap, that sort of thing.
Well, but we don't really have an idea, I guess, of what the word shotgun could have been based on verbally or etymologically.
We do, yeah. The word is, it looks like togu hyphen na, T-O-G-U hyphen N-A-N, togu na. The problem with that is we don't really have the written record, because obviously when slaves were brought to the New World, they didn't have writing and they didn't bring it with them. They didn't write it down. Also, there's a huge gap between the arrival of slaves, the loss of their language, and then the appearance of the phrase shotgun house in print, the giant gap. So it's really hard to explain how that word would have persisted and shown up in English. John Vlach certainly was an excellent researcher. He did extraordinary work to connect us to Haiti. He talks about in his work how the style of the shotgun house was probably brought to the United States by the French Creole who were escaping the Haitian Revolution. This is more than 200 years ago. Many of these houses were built in Louisiana, the Mississippi River Valley, and the Caribbean. So this is where you typically will find these houses, in places of black settlement in the United States. So shotgun houses are strongly associated with African-American culture in the United States. And they're a large part of the identity, especially in Louisiana, of black Louisianans and black language in Louisiana.
That really explains why Wilkerson would use the word more than once. That's interesting.
I want to recommend a book to you, which will tell you than I could possibly tell you now. It's by J. Dearborn Edwards, and this is a long name, but Nicolas Carouc Paquet du Ballet de Verton. I don't know if he pronounces it in the French way, but it's called A Creole Lexicon, Architecture, Landscape, People.
How wonderful. Okay, I will check that out.
Meanwhile, Connie, you've got me wanting to go back and reread The Warmth of Other Suns, because that it's like a novel, right? It's just this sweeping, majestic history of the Great Migration out of the Jim Crow South.
Yes, yeah, and knowing her process in interviewing more than 1,000 people, and then concluding, you know, determining the three lives that she, or families that she determined, because of their destinations. So, yes, it's great.
Well, thank you for sharing what you're reading and for bringing us a really interesting question about shotgun houses.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Take care now.
Thank you very much. All the best
to
you.
Best to you.
Thanks, Connie. Bye-bye.
We'll link to that book, A Creole Lexicon, on our website. And if you've got questions or comments or ideas on the way we live and the language about it, call us 877-929-9673 or email us words@waywardradio.org.
A few weeks ago, we talked about a Mexican slang term for taking a nap, voy a echarme un coyotito, which means I'm going to take a nap, but literally it's like you're taking a little coyote because of the way that coyotes curl up and nap in the middle of the day. I was talking with a Venezuelan friend about this, and she said where she grew up, what they said was voy a echar un zorrito, which means I'm going to have a little fox, zorrito, you know, like Zorro.
Right. We all know Zorro, but many people might not know that means fox.
Right. Yeah. And it was also explained to me that un zorrito is when you lie down with your eyes closed, but you're not sleeping. You're just sort of resting your mind and body. So I don't know if a coyotito is deeper than a zorrito. Mm-hmm. Maybe people can let us know about that. I started a zorrito the other day, and it went into a full nap.
That does tend to happen, Martha. Yeah, doesn't it?
No,
to all of us. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Good morning.
Good morning. Who am I talking with?
Betsy Flynn.
Where are you, Betsy?
I am in beautiful Murray, Kentucky. We are having a beautiful spring here.
Oh, that sounds good.
Well, did you call to share something fun with us?
I did. I was playing cards with my friends the other day, and one of them was complaining about her cards very good-naturedly. And I said, just quit your mully grubbing and play. And they all said, what did you say? And so since then, I've asked about 10 people, have you ever heard the term mully grubbing? And none of them had ever heard it. So I thought, I know who to ask about this because I love your show. I listen to it every time it's on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you came to the right place.
Quit your mully grubbing.
Quit your mully grubbing. And then I had asked my sister if she had heard that word, and she said the next day she heard it on television. She said, that's the first time I've ever heard it in my life. I thought evidently it didn't come from my family then, so I don't know where I had heard it.
Quit your mully grubbing, meaning quit your complaining, right?
Right.
Okay.
Quit your belly aching.
There you go. That would be closer than complaining.
Betsy, you will be very pleased to hear that mully grubbing is a perfectly legitimate word.
Okay.
The original version of the word mully grub is really, really old. It didn't even originate in this country. Mully grub goes back to the 1500s in the UK, where mully grub meant a state of depression or a bad mood. Or you might talk about, I have the mully grubs, and that means that you have a stomach ache or you have an intestinal upset. We don't know the origin of the word mully grub. It might come from an old word, megrim, M-E-G-R-I-M, that means migraine, or it might be related to that. We're just not sure, but if you look in the Dictionary of Southern Appalachian English, you will see mully grub used as a verb, meaning to either complain for no good reason or to be slightly unwell or slightly upset or to have the blues. And if somebody is mully grubby, then they're just kind of sulky, which sounds like the person you were playing cards with.
Only for a moment. That makes sense because my parents and grandparents were from East Tennessee, so I'm sure that's where it came from.
Yeah, it's pretty much in the South and particularly in Appalachia. So you're right on the money there. It's a perfectly legitimate word.
Yeah, and as a verb, mully grubbing goes back about 130 years or more.
Thank you, guys, and keep up the good work.
Oh,
right,
thank you
care.
So much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, whether it's the slang of the sport that you love or it's a linguistic heirloom that you learned from your parents and grandparents, share it with us. Tell us what you know and teach us a thing or two. 877-929-9673 or email words at waywardradio.org.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Sean Garrett from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware.
Hi, Sean. Welcome.
Hi, how are
What's
you?
What's on your mind?
I'm an editor, and I read a lot of short fiction, and I would occasionally run into two words that I know are almost certainly are slang terms, one fairly commonly, the other not so commonly, and they're both words for large amounts of money. The one is simoleons, and the other is spondulix. Simoleons I've heard fairly commonly. Spondulix I've only run into in, say, European. Like, I was reading a collection of stories by Bertolt Brecht at one point, and they use spondulix. It sounds like a Dutch word or something, but I was just wondering if you know those words and if you would know what the origins of them are.
They're both Americanisms. Spondulix, isn't Dutch, but it possibly has a Greek origin because there was a type of shell used as money, and also this the spondylo root refers to the spine or vertebrae, and there's one citation found by Douglas Wilson, who's a language researcher, in a book, and it has spondulix defined as coin piled for counting. So if you can imagine a stack of coins looking like a stack of vertebrae, so that's possibly the origin. It goes back to about 1847. Yeah, and simoleons are a little harder to pin down. There's so many stories about this, Martha, aren't there? So many stories about what simoleon might come from.
It always makes me think of semolina. I don't, you know, that's the only word it sounds close to.
Oh, you're on it. Sean, that's bingo. That's my favorite theory. The hard, rough wheat grinding is kind of used for pasta and soups because there is a long history of English for using food words to mean money. Mm-hmm. Cabbage and cheddar and chickpea and peanuts and coleander seeds, which was an obsolete word for coriander. And semolina looks kind of like coriander seeds. I could totally see semolina being used in a modified form to mean money, particularly because there's something like 16 different spellings of the word. None of them exactly like semolina, unfortunately. Another one is related to a British sixpence coin known as a simon that jumped to the United States. And another one is maybe it was related to the word simony, which is about the buying or selling of church pardons or appointments. Maybe mixed with the word Napoleon. Who knows? One really interesting side note that I just have to bring up is the first several uses of the term that we know of Samolian imprint, the first three or four, are all from the same magazine. It's the American satirical publication Puck, which was widely reprinted across the United States, and they are all written in mock biblical prose, just kind of like this fake kind of almost, you know, King James kind of writing. Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Highfalutin.
And so I think, and they all sound like the same writer. So I think one person coined this word, published it in Puck, it was reprinted everywhere else, and that is the source of the word. I think maybe they were trying to make up a currency name that sounded biblical.
And yet was funny. Since Puck was
humor. Slightly humorous because simoleon sounds vaguely, there's something automatically kind of like not, you don't take it seriously, right? Well, I gotta tell you, Sean, that was it was a delight to talk to you about these terms. I don't often get a chance to flex my slang muscle, so I appreciate the call.
Excellent, and maybe I'll call back with a few more if I go check my notes.
That'd be great.
All right, be well.
All right, take care.
Bye bye.
We're always interested in the words and phrases that catch your eye when you're doing your reading, fiction from the 1920s or online. So give us a call, 877-929-9673, or send it to us in email. That address is words@waywardradio.org.
This show is about language seen through family, history, and culture. Stay tuned. You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Old English is the vernacular that was spoken in England from about the year 550 to 1150. And it's very different from the English that's spoken today. It really sounds a lot more like a mashup of Scandinavian languages and German. But even if you don't understand Old English, it can be mesmerizing to listen to. And one word from that version of English is hoard, H-O-R-D. It means treasure, and it also carries the sense of something valuable that's hidden and locked away. Hoard is also a part of the compound Old English noun word hoard, and that's the treasure of words that you have stored up inside yourself. In fact, there's an Old English poem about a man named Widsith who's wandered far and wide, and it begins like this. Widsith Matholada, word hoard on Leac, which means Widsith spoke, unlocked his word hoard, and then the rest of the poem is him unloading about his travels. And you can hear the rhythm and alliteration that's so typical of Old English poetry in those first lines, Widsith Matholada, word hoard on Leac. And if you want to splash around a bit in Old English, there's a new book that will help you do that. It's called The Word Hoard, Daily Life in Old English. It's by Hannah Vidine, who did her doctoral work on this topic, and it's a very accessible, almost conversational book about life in early medieval England, and it's divided into chapters on such topics as eating and drinking, medicine, animals, religion. And what I find really valuable about this book is that at the end of each chapter, she compiles a word hoard of all those old English words that she's mentioned with their pronunciations and their definitions. And that gives you the chance to roll these words around in your mouth and give you a really delicious taste of the language and the culture of that time. I really think you'd enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. It's a right down my alley, Martha.
Yeah, or right up your alley.
And what's so perfect about this is that you feel that you know it. It's like meeting the sibling of your best friend. And they look alike, and they sound alike, and they share some of the same traits, but they're not your friend. But boy, it just feels like you could get to know them really well. It's just so close to what we know as English today, and yet not quite English today.
I don't know if it's a sibling or if it's a grandparent. You know,
right.
It's an ancestor.
Yeah.
But I really would recommend just going online, and we can link to some sites that have great renditions of Old English poetry. Some of it is just heart-rending, talking about sorrow and loss, but in this very beautiful, beautiful meter and rhythm and alliteration.
So word hoard itself is a type of word known as a kenning, and I believe the book talks about those as well.
Yes. For example, there's a term in Old English that literally means sky candle, but it's a word for sun. And the sea is described as the whale road. And a sailor on the sea is sometimes described as the equivalent of a sea guest, a guest on the water out there.
Sea guest, whale road. How delightful. So two nouns put together to make this compound word that, it's just gorgeous.
right. A kenning, as you said, K-E-N-N-I-N-G.
That book again, Martha?
It's called The Word Hoard, Daily Life in Old English by Hannah Vidine. And I should add that she also tweets a word of the day at Old English Word Hoard, O-E Word Hoard.
Well, break open your word hoard and share it with us, 877-929-9673, or put your word hoard into your keyboard, words at waywardradio.org.
Hey there, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Kelly calling from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well.
Great. I am calling because I am originally from Houston, Texas, and there is a word that my dad uses all the time that my sister and I are always confused on why and where this comes from. And it's the word gradu. He always mentions, like, pick up that piece of gradu on the floor. And it's like just like a piece of paper, like a little crumb or like a leaf. Or when we were kids, he'd be like, clean up your rooms. You guys have gradu everywhere. Or if the porch is dirty, you need to sweep. There's gradu all over the porch. So I'm just wondering, one, is this a real word? And two, how do you spell it? And where did it, what's its deal? Is this, does anyone else say this besides my dad?
What's its deal? Well, it's deal, Kelly.
We should change the name of the show.
What's the deal about words?
What's the deal with this word? I know.
So we've talked about this on the show, what, two or three times? And we've talked about this on our live shows when we go on the road. And we always get a really great response on this. And we have so many voicemails and emails about this word because lots of people are like you. They don't really hear it lots of places. So when they hear it on a national radio show or they hear it in our podcast, they're like, what? I thought only my family used it. And they're really shocked. And they call us and write us and tell us stories. Dave from Wisconsin said his mother uses it like your father. His mother uses it to mean clutter or stuff. But he's from Iowa. But, you know, a lot of our listeners are from the South. A lot of them are from Louisiana or Texas. A lot of them have some connection to French or Cajun culture. Lynn in Maine wrote that she learned it in the 1980s from an Anglophone Canadian, and they used it. She uses it to mean anything from a smudge to a pile or lump of ick. So lots of different, the spellings could be G-R-A-D-O-O. Ginger, who grew up in Eunice, Louisiana, said her mama used the word, and they spell it G-R-A-D-E-A-U, like a French spelling. And they use to the crusty, greasy stuff in your skillet after you fried a piece of meat. But she writes that they would use it to make their gravy. And she said it was weird for her to learn what most folks consider to be gunk or grime they use as a necessity to create delicious gravy.
Well, see, I can't imagine eating a gravy. Yeah, a gravy made of gradu just sounds terrible to me. The way it's used.
So as to where it comes from, there's a Martha and I've always believed that there's something Frenchy about this, as do many of our correspondents. One is that it's from one of the French words that means mud. Gadou, G-A-D-O-U-E. And at one time that word meant manure, although that's an outdated meaning now. But it's missing that crucial R. And one of the reasons that word might have some currency, though, is that there was a song written by Serge Gainsbourg, recorded by Jane Birkin and Petula Clark and some other people, that I think was a hit around 1966. And Vincent, who is French and lives in San Diego, told us about it and said that when he was a kid, he and his friends, when they would come inside from the house with mud on their shoes, would sing the song. And it goes something like, gadou, 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 at the chorus, something like that. And it's mud, my mud, my mud, my mud, my mud, something like that.
Amazing.
You can look it up. Yeah. But again, it's missing that crucial R, but you might see how that got inserted in there. And then several listeners have suggested a French-Canadian phrase, gradeur, which means really fatty. G-R-I-S space D-U-R.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, but it's used figuratively to mean lucky or happy or fulfilled. Il est gradeur. He's very happy. But the problem is that's kind of the opposite of gradeur. It's a positive, not a negative. And I don't see how that gets us to gradeur unless it started its life among the Acadians who became the Cajuns and before the modern French-Canadian phrase took its meaning. You know, it's possible.
So we don't know, Kelly.
we don't know. Hell, I'll just throw theories at you all day long.
But your dad is not alone. That's the bottom line there.
Very interesting theories here. We're still to crack the code of what the deal is with this word. But I really appreciate these things. This is really interesting.
Thank you for putting up with this gradu of a conversation. We really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.
Oh, we appreciate you.
I can't wait to tell my dad.
Thank you for calling. Take care, Kelly.
Sure.
Thanks, Kelly.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Call us 877-929-9673. Some of the music you're hearing on today's show is the work of Surefire Soul Ensemble. That's a 9-piece Afro-funk and soul jazz band, and the guy who plays the organ and electric piano for them is Tim Felton. As it happens, Tim is also the editor and engineer for this very program.
We want to give a big shout-out to Surefire Soul Ensemble because their latest album debuted in the top 15 of Billboard's Contemporary Jazz chart. It's called Step Down. We will post more information about it on our website. And by the way, you can always find all of the songs mentioned by name and artist on our website. Go to waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Janine Hilligus, and I reside in Charleston, South Carolina.
Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to the show.
What can we do for you, Janine?
I was born in southwestern Pennsylvania. Nothing but little coal mining villages, very ethnic, Eastern European, you know, Polish, Hungarian, Romanian, Czechoslovakian. And the folks there, I heard it from my parents as well as my grandparents and childhood friends. If you encountered someone, and we'd be driving about the countryside, that had a lot of junk, like mattresses thrown down over the hillside or washing machines, refrigerators, and just disheveled, you know, their surroundings, my family would say, oh, they're nothing but feather merchants. And this is, I believe, unique to that area because anytime I've asked others, they are totally unfamiliar with it. And I guess it just means someone trashy or lazy, is what I concluded as a child.
Well, Janine, I'm wondering, do any of those family members who use the term feather merchant in a derogatory way, do any of them have any military in their background?
No, definitely not.
Interesting.
Yeah, it surprises me.
Yeah, it surprises me too, because, of course, there really were feather merchants in the past, you know, in the 1800s. Those were business people who literally sold feathers for use in clothes making and pillows and things like that. But in the mid-20th century in this country, the term feather merchant took on another kind of meaning, specifically among members of the U.S. military. It referred to somebody who was kind of a lightweight, like a feather, somebody who is a weakling, or somebody who shirks responsibility, or maybe has an undeservedly cushy job. And the term was used specifically to refer to civilians. People in the military would refer to civilians as feather merchants. You know, they were lightweights. They didn't put their lives on the line. They didn't have to obey the chain of command. And so you can see how a dismissive term like that, that's why I was asking if there were any military connection, because it was kind of a dismissive term referring to civilians.
Isn't that interesting? Because I have been sitting here going through my head in terms of, you know, military experience. And my one uncle was in the Army in the early 60s. However, I really never heard it from him. That was on my paternal side. But I, you know, just recently was asking my 88-year-old dad, you know, and he said that the coal mines at one time, there was like a migration from Kentucky to that specific area. I know there was, you know, Route 23 people seeking employment in the north, but this was specific to the coal mines, I believe, because it was like union wages or whatever. And mm-hmm. he said there was an influx of folks, and they kind of kept their environment junky and were not neat and tidy and somewhat slackers. So I thought maybe it had to do with like they threw their mattress and migrated, hence the feathers, a feather bed. But no one could ever explain it. So,
what do you think about the shirker or lazy part of the explanation Martha gave?
Well, I think that was pretty apropos in terms of, you know, how they would look at the environment and say they're nothing but a feather merchant, because, again, they were kind of lazy or unmotivated. So that aspect of it definitely makes sense. So I appreciate it. I thank you.
You're welcome. And we should point out it's not at all localized like that. It's well beyond Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it's widespread across the United States. And as a matter of fact, there are occasional uses of it before the mid-20th century, maybe going back 2,000 years old. But it's always hard to tell in the past whether or not they meant it literally or figuratively. But there are some uses that look like they meant it to mean somebody who was not on the up and up. Thank you for your call, Janine. We appreciate it. Take care.
You too. Bye. Okay. And I really enjoy Bye-bye. Your show. I've learned a lot.
Thank you very
Fantastic.
Much.
Fantastic. Call Bye-bye. Again sometime. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
No matter where you're from, you've got expressions that feel local and they feel special to you and the people that you love. Call us and share them with the world. 877-929-9673 or email us words@waywardradio.org.
I recently took a very cool class in falconry at Sky Falconry in the mountains just outside of San Diego, and I was reminded of all the great vocabulary that's associated with falconry, like, for example, haggard originally described an adult female hawk that was caught in the wild and not raised in captivity, and then later that was applied to humans who were kind of wild-looking. And also pride of place, which originally meant the airy height from which a falcon swoops, and Shakespeare uses it that way in Macbeth, talking about a falcon towering in her pride of place. And then there was a word that I learned from the instructors that was new to me, and that was feeking. Do you know this word, Grant? Feeking.
I don't know what feeking is. Is this maybe picking at the animal underneath their claws?
Well, feeking is what happens after that. To feek is to wipe the bill on something in order to clean it or to hone it, you know, to make it really sharp or to just wipe that food off your face if you're a falcon.
Do you have any idea of the origin of that word, or is it just so old that we don't know?
That's a good suspicion because we're not completely sure. It may come from an old German word that means to clean, but we're not totally sure.
So that's feeking, F-E-A-K, to wipe the food off your face or your beak.
Yeah.
So if you have a runny nose, you can feek it with a tissue.
Share the language of your hobbies with us, 877-929-9673. Our team includes senior producer Stephanie Levine, engineer and editor Tim Felton, production assistant Rachel Elizabeth Weisler, and quiz guy John Chinesky.
We'd love to hear from you, no matter where you are in the world. Go to waywardradio.org/contact.
Subscribe to the podcast, hear hundreds of past episodes, and get the newsletter at waywardradio.org.
Whenever you have a language story or question, our toll-free line is open in the U.S. and Canada, 1-877-929-9673. Or send your thoughts to words@waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward, Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
Special thanks to Michael Breslauer, Josh Eccles, Claire Grotting, Bruce Rogo, Rick Seidenworm, and Betty Willis.
Thanks for listening. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
We choose our on-air guests from among our podcast listeners, so if you'd like to be on the show, you don't have to be listening live or even be in the United States. There are lots of ways to send us a message or a voice note at waywardradio.org/contact.
WRCT Pittsburgh, welcome to our little experiment in freeform radio.
Here's a song all about my deep devotion and love to the banjo. Yeah, there's a lot of jokes about the banjo. Silver strings are really fun to play. I learned a lot of jokes about the banjo. Try to memorize a new one every day. I admit that the banjo isn't sexy. It makes all the pretty girls run away. I learn a thing or two about the banjo, like the finest birth control is when you play. Oh, the world is full of jokes about the banjo. Some so bad they leave you in dismay. There's millions of jokes about the banjo. Here's a few to brighten up your day. What's the best way to tune a banjo? Wire cutters. You know, most banjo players spend half their career tuning and the other half playing out of tune. You know the difference between a banjo and a fish? You can tune a fish. How do you know the stage is level, John? Banjo player drools out of both sides of his mouth. What's the difference between a banjo and a yugo? You can tune a yugo. I know, most of you are going, what's a yugo? All the banjo players are going, what's tuning? What's the definition of an optimist? That's a banjo player with a pager. What do you say to a banjo player in a three-piece suit? Will the defendant please rise? Hey, Howard.
Yes, Michael.
What's the difference between a banjo and a puppy? Eventually, the puppy stops whining. What's the definition of a gentleman? That's someone who knows how to play the banjo, but doesn't. What does a banjo and a lawsuit have in common? Everybody feels better when the case is closed. How do you get a banjo player's eyes to sparkle? You shine a flashlight in his ears. How do you make a banjo player slow down, John? Put sheet music in front of him. Hey, Howard.
Yes, Michael.
Why are there no banjos in the movie Star Wars? Because it's the future. And finally, my favorite banjo joke of all. What do you call a beautiful woman on the arms of a banjo player? A tattoo. There's a lot of jokes about the banjo. Silver strings are really fun to play. There's millions of jokes about the banjo. I memorize a new one every day. I admit the banjo isn't sexy. It chases all those pretty girls away. But one thing that I've learned about the banjo, the finest birth control is when you play. Well, the world is full of jokes about the banjo. Some so bad they leave you in dismay. There's millions of jokes about the banjo. I hope you enjoyed a few today.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Check, check, check.
Yeah.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Hey, Pittsburgh, this is Eric Harrison coming to you with a heart full of gratitude on WRCT Pittsburgh. Rock on, Yinzers.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, powerless in the United States, how utilities drive shutoffs and energy injustice. That's an ongoing project from the Center for Biological Diversity, the Energy and Policy Institute, and Bailout Watch. It tracks utility service disconnections and corporate profiteering, because as it turns out, those are flip sides of a coin. You and I might think that in disastrous weather conditions, with no signs of stopping, and a pandemic, and low wages, and a hike in prices, it would be a time to acknowledge workers' sacrifices and support them. Silly us. Actually, it's a moment for powerful companies to raise prices on consumers, not to recoup any losses, but just to raise profits, as their shareholder speeches will proudly reveal. And why would that gouging stop at life-saving vaccines or medicines? Why not also shut off the power to the homes of struggling families? Seriously, why not? If Wall Street will reward you for it, and corporate news media won't call you out, or even seriously, humanistically report on what you're doing. Or, even easier, one might think, argue for the basic transparency that would allow that reporting. Electric utilities have disconnected U.S. households more than 4 million times since the beginning of COVID, preceding the Russian war on Ukraine. At the same time, shareholder payouts went up by $1.9 billion, increases that could have paid those households' bills five times over. Our guest's work illustrates how energy bills take up more and more of families' earnings and how the actions of corporations take a tough and sometimes life-threatening situation, make it worse, and then hand it off to their allies in the press corps, who they know will present it as business as usual, if regrettable, but above all, nothing worth looking into or talking about seriously. They aren't just complaining. They have ideas about what's needed to address the situation. Shelby Green is research fellow at the Energy and Policy Institute. Selah Goodson-Bell is energy justice campaigner at the Center for Biological Diversity. We'll hear from both of them this week on the show. But first, a look back at some recent press. It's hard to find words after yet another brutal police killing of a black person, this time of 29-year-old Tyre Nichols in Memphis, captured in horrifying detail on video footage released last week. But the words we use, and in that we, the journalists who frame these stories, figure critically, those words, if we actually want to not just be sad about, but to end state-sanctioned racist murders, those words mustn't downplay or soften the hard reality with euphemism and vagary. But that's exactly what the New York Times did in recent coverage. In its January 28th front page story, reporter Rick Rojas led with an unflinching description of the brutal footage, noting that Tyre Nichols showed no signs of fighting back, under his violence.